Welcome to the Debate at Geo8 podcast series. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Jeff Raby, a foremost expert on Australia-China relations. Jeff was Australia's ambassador to China from 2007 to 2011. After 27 years in the public service and on completing his ambassadorial term, he established Jeff Raby and Associates, a Beijing-based business advisory firm helping Australian and Chinese businesses run successful operations across cultures and borders, and informing public and private policymakers. Closer to home, he's a member of the University of Sydney's China Studies Centre Advisory Board. In 2015, Dr. Raby was part of the consultative committee for the draft of Australia's National Strategy for International Education, something of great interest to the Geo8. I'm Ron Candelars, a freelance journalist and producer, and throughout this series, we've been canvassing a range of topics touching upon the work of all the Group of Eight universities. They include the Australian National University, Monash University, UNSW Sydney, the Universities of Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Queensland, and Western Australia. In the studio with me is Vicky Thompson, the CEO of the Group of Eight. Well, firstly, Dr. Raby, China is our largest trading partner, despite the testy relationship between both countries following COVID, and that's unlikely to change. Who needs who the most?
Oh, we need each other. It's a symbiotic relationship. And obviously, China is hugely dependent on Australia's natural resources, energy, agricultural products, our universities to educate students overseas. But equally, as you said, China, our largest market, and despite nearly 3 years of trade restrictions against Australia, Australian exports this year at $171 billion are at the record.
Your 2020 book, China's Grand Strategy and Australia's Future in the New Global Order, points the way to getting Australia's relationship with China back on track. How do we do that?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to recognise that we are essential to each other. We have to have a very clear understanding that we will pursue our own interests. But very much it's an old formula, one that really was spelled out very clearly by John Howard back in the late 1990s. You remember that when Howard first became Prime Minister, the relationship went into a nosedive. Howard was the deputy sheriff. He was the only world leader to applaud Clinton sending two carrier fleets through the Taiwan Straits. And China then, as of recent years, put us in the deep freeze to register their great displeasure with our behaviour. But Howard thought about this, went to China, visited, and recognised the tremendous opportunity in China for Australia, and came away with a formula which was basically acknowledge explicitly, recognise our differences, but do not let the differences define the relationship. We have huge common interests, and so it's to focus on the common interests rather than the differences. And I think this is where the Morrison government period really went off the rails. They began to define the relationship entirely in terms of the differences, the issues that divide us, as legitimate as those issues are, rather than focusing on our common interests. And I think that brought it to the very parlous state that we found the relationship in when the Labor government was elected. Now, there are other challenges, which I point out in my book. You know, China is a growing dominant power in the region. It's not going to go away. It's going to become more powerful, more dominant, and more influential. We then have to work out how we deal with a power that doesn't share our values, doesn't share the same assumptions about how the world should work and how we should organize our societies. And that's a diplomatic challenge. That's a huge diplomatic challenge. But we have to rise to it. And I think in many ways, if you look at Penny Wong's speech this week at the National Press Club, she outlined a number of the things I'd set out very clearly in my book nearly 3 years ago, and that is we have to be very active and innovative in coalition building. We need to think creatively how we can raise the cost to China of its bad behaviour, but equally do this in a very explicit, open and non-confrontational way, and constantly remind China, as they do for themselves, we are pursuing our interests. It's become more complicated, of course, in recent times with things like the elevation of the Quad to a summit level and, of course, the AUKUS agreement. But that postdates the arguments I was putting forward in my book. But active engagement, bringing Australia much closer to ASEAN, and linking our interests more closely with ASEAN is, I think, a key to being able to navigate through this very complicated diplomatic space.
How do you think China sees us? Do they see us as a middle power in the Indo-Pacific region? How do they see us?
Well, very much a middle power in the region. They see us in the past, much less so, as having been very active diplomatically. I always recall an anecdote when I first arrived in China as ambassador back in 2007, which is, I know, ancient history now. The foreign ministry took me to one side one day and said, "What has happened to Australia in the region? Once Australia was a dynamic, innovative, diplomatic country in the region. You created APEC. You were big supporters of the whole PEC process, great advocates of open trade, regional, deeper regional integration. You, together with Indonesia, forged the Cambodian peace development. Also together with Indonesia, developed the Bali process on people smuggling." And the list goes on and on. And of course, we worked very, very closely with China in helping them achieve their WTO accession. So they saw Australia in that period as being very active and very constructive in regional diplomacy, and they welcomed it. And they said to me, "You do things we would like to do, but we can't, because if we were to do these things, if we were to show leadership on these matters, others, meaning the United States, of course, would block them." So I think their view has changed in more recent times. And one, I think they've seen Australia as being less innovative and less creative in regional diplomacy, but also I think matters like AUKUS would concern them, that we are turning away from Asia and seeing our interests much more closely aligned with the US and the UK, essentially looking to the Anglosphere to support order in the region. And I think for the Chinese, this would be a very disappointing development.
Jeff, you and I were involved in a dinner with China's Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs recently, and one of the recurring themes of that discussion and subsequent coverage of that was really a desire by the minister to understand what went so badly wrong in his view. And we were asked, you know, what went wrong since 2016, I think, was the sort of time period that he was looking at, mm-hmm. and kept going back to that. And Jeff, you gave a very interesting expose, almost sort of where you've just come from then, in terms of where you think we went wrong. Well, not where we went wrong, but where they might think we went wrong. Do you think that they are placated by the response from the Australian government and us, or do you think we're in this completely new paradigm now where we can't look at what went wrong or didn't go wrong, but we're now in this new environment?
Yeah, Vicky, it's a good question. That's a hard one, obviously, to answer. But let me have a go in this way. I first of all, at that dinner, was very struck by Vice Minister Ma, how genuinely concerned and disappointed and sad he sounded about where the bilateral relationship got to. And I think that is a genuine sense of loss. He, after all, was ambassador to Australia. He's been involved in Australian affairs on and off for a big part of his career. Secondly, I'd say that they worry about how the relationship can be improved and de-risked at the same time. I think that was a theme that came out through the dinner. But it's quite clear that China decided before the last election to set about improving the bilateral relationship. I think the element of risk is the main constraint at present on how quickly they're prepared to move forward. But also, I think, and I've made these points, you'll recall, at the dinner, China has to look at its own behaviour as well. China did a lot to damage its standing in the world with this wolf warrior diplomacy, as it's called, aggressive stance towards other nations, even friendly nations. They lost the opportunity to have a bilateral investment agreement with Europe through really just bad behaviour by sanctioning members of the European Parliament. Some of their language directed towards Australia was just utterly unacceptable. And that has been a big problem. And China throwing its weight around the world in various places, South China Sea is just one of a number. Overall, all these sort of, if you like, assertive, aggressive behaviours by China have set back China's soft power enormously. And again, when I first went to Beijing's ambassador in 2007, people were rushing to go to China, rushing to be there, rushing to be part of this opening, expansive experience. But that's all gone. And they're going to have to work hard.
Do you think we'll ever get that back? Do you think we'll ever go back to that?
No, not generally, in terms of a view of China as an exciting, dynamic, welcoming place. But equally, in terms of our bilateral relationship, I think trust has been severely damaged. And the other element I was just going to make, Vicky, was that their application of trade measures against Australia were really counterproductive. It was a huge tactical mistake by the Beijing leadership. They know that. I think that's why they're trying to walk backwards without losing face from those measures. And just on your point about where do we get back to, or will we get back to the previous period, I think I said the other night that they'll certainly never get back to an effervescent relationship the way it was. But what's also changed is that in the last 5 or 6 years, the US has explicitly decided to treat China as a strategic competitor. And as Hugh White warned in 2012 when he wrote the book, The China Choice, if and when the US ever did that, it would have profound implications and consequences for Australia's relations with China and how we manage those relations. So I think I also made the point, I did on the dinner the other night, that once the US has made this its change, we now have to, both sides, China and Australia, have to work out how to navigate a much more narrowly constrained diplomatic space.
It puts us in a very
both sides has become much, much harder.
It puts us in a very invidious position, though, doesn't it? And of course, that's heightened with the prospect of AUKUS. And I'm actually heading to the States next week to meet with various US officials on the Pillar 2 of AUKUS and the science and technology that will underpin a lot of that agreement, and meeting with my counterparts from the UK and the US. How do you think the AUKUS is viewed from the China side? I think it's a rhetorical question. And how do we manage that invidious position, given we do have this incredibly, huge defence agreement about to be sort of embarked upon with the very people that we have to make, well, apparently, these choices with?
It's complicated, massively, managing that relationship in this new constrained world that we find ourselves in. And as I said earlier, we've tossed our lot in with the Anglosphere to try and support the US in maintaining order in the region. And Penny Wong made that very clear in her press club speech the other day. I mean, her speech was effectively back to the old, all the way with the USA. So how China views AUKUS, I think it's a number of different levels. First of all, the announcements of the last month would have been all factored in and discounted because AUKUS has been talked about now for 20-odd months without any substance. So eventually there's going to be substance put into it. Secondly, it's such a long-term, out there project. We of the Never Never, some wit has described it as. It doesn't change the strategic balance, certainly not in the next 15, 20 years. So it's no, if you like, strategic threat to China. And frankly, the number of submarines that we will acquire over this extended period, if in fact we ever acquire them, China will have constructed that number many times over in the same period, assuming submarines are still a relevant military option that far out. So I think the problem with AUKUS, from my perspective, and I think the Chinese leadership would be unsettled by this, is that it's really a statement of Australia that we see the long-term stability of the region being one where the United States is strongly supported by Australia in advancing its interests in the region. So it really does put us firmly in the US camp.
Jeff, if I can paraphrase some of your criticism of diplomatic efforts more recently, is that, the Australian view on China has been that China changed, we didn't. It's up to them to behave differently. We're not going to give up our values and be pushed around. Some would say, what's wrong with that position, given that China was pretty strident about the South China Sea, trade barriers, et cetera, all of those things? What's your essential concern about that approach by Australian governments?
Well, quite simply, it gives up agency. We surrender agency to China. We're saying there's nothing we can do. We are innocent victims, babes in the wood. Feel sorry for us, and it's all up to China to fix. And I don't think that's the sensible thing for a sovereign country to be doing. So it's about agency, and we have to look at our own capacity to manage more complex diplomatic relations, which are going to get more and more complex and difficult and challenging in the future. So that's my principal concern with that approach. However, it's actually not true. Once the United States, about 2015, clearly defined and categorized China as a strategic competitor, we changed as well. And the change has been on both sides. And so, it's cause and effect, who knows? The reality is, for many years now, we have drawn closer and closer to the US in treating China as a strategic competitor. And we've done that without asking some basic questions. What sort of threat is China to Australia? Now, it certainly is a threat to US primacy. And the US treating China as a strategic competitor is all about US retaining primacy. But is it for a third country like Australia to see our interests aligned and connected directly with US primacy? Certainly ASEAN does not see that way. And in the last week or so, Kishore Marabani, the former Singaporean foreign secretary, made a very interesting observation that we in Australia have decided to go a different way, a different direction from ASEAN in its relations with China, in a way that we have basically given up ASEAN as the key strategic partner in balancing China and pushing back on China, to relying on a non-present UK and, of course, the US, which is pursuing its primacy over China rather than regional balance.
The other point I want to pick up too is that I noticed in some of your writing there seems to be a subtle difference in the way you see the approach of Penny Wong as foreign minister compared to the approach of Albanese as prime minister. Could you speak to that?
Well read. Thanks. To me, Albanese has never had a foreign policy background. He's not invested. He's invested hardly any time in these issues, which require actually an enormous amount of engagement. He has basically taken a script from his national security advisors and followed that. And the best example of that was when he was probably a little bit overwhelmed by the occasion in Madrid for the NATO meeting last year, where we were one of a number of add-ons. And he started talking about a single NATO theater, meaning that NATO would be aligned against China as well as against Russia. And the NATO partners certainly don't have that view of NATO. And a number of European leaders made that very clear. So it's things like that. Whereas Penny Wong is much more subtle in her approach. She has done a very credible job in rebuilding our relations with the Pacific, worked very hard on ASEAN, except that in her case, the fundamental issue is that before the last election, the Labor Party, to avoid being wedged by the coalition on national security, made Labor's foreign policy and security policy indistinguishable from that of Morrison, and they're stuck with implementing it now. Mm. You know, from AUKUS, from elevating the Quad, everything we do, is basically implementing Morrison's the former Morrison government's foreign policy, because they tactically didn't want to have any opportunity of being attacked on being soft on national security. That's where we find ourselves. Now, I think Albanese doesn't really get that, in my view, and certainly I think Penny Wong does, but she's got to manage, one of those unpleasant sandwiches.
So imagine then you're back as ambassador to China for the Australian government, and you're giving advice to this current government about a middle path, a new way of dealing with China and America in these, geopolitical times. What would you be advising?
Well, God forbid I'd ever go back as ambassador. I'm not Kevin Rudd. My best advice is the advice I can give outside of government. And essentially, I think we need to define a much more independent foreign policy stance. We need to bring ourselves much closer to the way ASEAN balances its interests, both with the United States and with China. I think Penny Wong and the government have done a lot of good things with China. They've got discipline now in the rhetoric. I mean, the last government was shocking, the way ministers would just shoot off at the mouth over major relationship, like the relationship with China. So there's good discipline amongst ministers and cabinet. Very careful not to make China a whipping boy. There's control over the rhetoric, language, and so on. So all of that's very good. I'm sure the trade disputes will be resolved in coming weeks, if not months, and we can start to step back towards a more normal relationship, which is clearly being flagged by both sides. So we need to be clear to China about where we stand on issues that divide us, but then go back to the old Howard formula and move on to identify the things that unite us or that we have common cause and purpose in. But we also should be very active in engaging China in a range of multilateral areas where they have an interest. We should definitely support China's admission to the Comprehensive Trade Agreement, CCPTT, if I've got the acronym correct. And of course, it's not our decision at all by ourselves. It requires consensus of all members, and China has to come up to the level of obligations that already exist. If both things happen, Australia should be an enthusiastic supporter of China joining. We have always welcome China into multilateral forums as part of our long-term strategy with managing China to tie it into the multilateral system as much as we can, or the regional systems of rules. So we should be doing that. There are new creative things. We should talk to China about disarmament in the region, try and promote new activity around these areas of conflict and security. We, as the biggest energy exporter in the region, and China as the biggest energy importer, should be working on a regional framework of energy security. There's a whole agenda that can be pursued jointly and constructively with China that they would be prepared to engage in. But we have to get the bilateral relationship back to a normal level before we can properly have these discussions.
And I think that recalibration that you mentioned has been recognised certainly from the China side, and that's apparent in the rhetoric that we're now seeing. Can I just bring you to my world, and that's universities for a moment? So our universities, the Group of Eight, we have an incredibly strong relationship with both research and students. And whilst the rest of the sector over COVID as it relates to Chinese students dipped, we actually increased our numbers with Chinese students. And not only did we increase them, but we held on to students over a very long period of time. And the Chinese government made significant concessions to enable those students to stay and study with us. So I think now we've got over 70% of all Chinese students at university in Australia are at our eight universities. And importantly, in terms of the research relationship, we are now, that is our fastest growing area. And you talked about, you know, the security relationship. Of course, we got caught up in all of that palaver with the previous government that any research with China was not good.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, we're not doing sensitive research with China. We're doing, you know, we do that with our Australian eyes only or with our Five Eyes partners. But there's a whole bunch of research we do in the humanities and social sciences and health, et cetera, clinical medicine, that's really important. So from our perspective, I'd like to think that we're kind of getting over that hump that not all engagement with China is bad. But our relationship did sustain a very tricky and difficult time and has continued to. I'd be interested in your observations of why you think that is and was the case. Do you think that will continue for our universities? And then in the domestic context, it's not always seen in a positive light. And in fact, I spoke to a joint committee of parliament yesterday, and this issue was raised by some that you know, there are some racist elements, frankly, to our international students and to our Chinese students. So there's a lot to unpack there. I appreciate that, Jeff, but I'd be really interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, I think one of the great lessons we can take from how well the university sector managed the relationship with China through the very difficult period politically in the bilateral relationship, but also the shock of the external shock of COVID, is the way the sector kept dialogue, connections, linkages, discussions, and relationships going. After all, the bedrock of doing anything with China are personal relationships. I know it's cliched. Any business conference will come out with this, but it is actually, in fact, the reality. You do need to have those very strong personal relationships. And so I think the university sector, a group of eight, but beyond that, you know, can really congratulate itself on both sides that you had built such strong and resilient relationships. You are able to withstand some of these quite powerful body blows that the relationship has received. So I have a lot of confidence in that and going forward. And I also think it's a lesson for the broader relationship more generally. And I think that will continue to grow and develop. And look, on sensitive things, national security related stuff, you just have to be very upfront with the Chinese where the limits are. They have their own limits. We have ours, perfectly legitimate, but we have to be clear about it. Now, there may have been a degree of naivety amongst some areas of the higher education research sectors in the past, but that's gone, and I don't think that will ever come back. But we must, in terms of Australia's national interest, and when you're talking to parliamentarians, I think always these things must be expressed in terms of our national interest. In terms of our national interest, we can't not engage with the Chinese higher education and research sectors. We simply cannot. I mean, the amount of investment that goes into China compared to our capacity to invest, we need to have collaborative, constructive arrangements.
Well, we'd just be left behind if we didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's absolutely in Australia's national interest. Mm. So I think if I could give you gratuitously any advice, Vicky, I'm sure you're doing it. It's to tease out always how Australia benefits from these sorts of relationships. I mean, the media, the ranters in the media, and we know who they all are, love to paint these relationships as a one-way street. We're being sucked dry by the Chinese. They're taking everything from us. We're suckers, we're gullible. It's a script, you know, you can repeat in your sleep. Mm. But it's not true. These are two-way streets. We're not naive and gullible when we deal with China and these things. We will have limits in certain strategic or defense areas, and that's as it should be. But as you say, you know, so much of medicine, so much of the humanities, arts, whatever, we can only benefit from that relationship.
I suppose also, Jeff, it points out that, you know, we had a moment where there was hardly any relationship between governments, but it was the university sector through its work that maintained this soft power and some sort of dialogue.
Absolutely. And I think we have to recognise that's been an extremely important thing for Australia as a nation in terms of maintaining some connection with a very major player in the region. But I also want to put a plug in, if I can, for my pet hobby, and that is culture relations. We cannot go hard enough on the cultural relationship. And if we do that, each side will stop seeing each other in stereotypical ways and we'll start to deal with each other as we are, interesting, complex, engaging, friendly, non-racist people on both sides. So the cultural dimension, I think, is extremely important. And that probably faded away a bit in the last few years. It certainly needs to be redoubled our efforts in coming years.
Dr. Jeff Robey, we'll have to leave it there. Maybe we'll have to get you back for another session because there's so much more to talk to. But thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for your company today. If you'd like more information about the issues raised in this podcast or other related topics, please visit our website at go8.edu.au. And a quick reminder, that you can always tune in to the debate at GO8 on Spotify, Google, Apple, or YouTube. Bye for now.